session number 19101, Reel 6.
Hans Tasker, Reel 6.
In the camp was, as I said, excellent. The different huts were housing 50 prisoners, and we had good bedding, everything you need for comfort was there. We had large showers and bathrooms and so on. We couldn't wish for a better condition. So the dining rooms were there. There were four dining rooms in each of the satellite camps. There were three satellite camps of four kitchens each. You had three meals a day, breakfast, normally cornflakes and toast and so on. Then, as a majority of people went for work, there were sandwiches and light refreshment at lunchtime. And in the evening was a main meal. It was actually a three-course meal. Plenty meat, plenty fruit, plenty vegetable. In fact, the majority of people of, let us say, the working class could never afford a lifestyle like that. So it was perfect in every way. There were guard towers around the camp, searchlights in case of a problem. They did have a problem once, where they had to use a searchlight, and where they had to use a whole, let us say, a column of fire engines to douse the protesters. There was a small group who wanted to protest about something. I still don't know what it was about, but anyhow, they got the soaking and it finished all right.
Seems surprising that somebody wanted to protest if conditions were so good.
We have no idea what the protest was about. So there was a fourth camp. The fourth camp was separated from us by a huge sports field, which was used rarely because we had our own sports fields within the camp, football pitch and so on. But the fourth camp was just beyond that, and it was intended for the generals and higher ranking officers. But they were not to mix with us too often and too closely. Anyhow, they were there, but many officers, generals, came to visit us occasionally. They couldn't be prevented. They came to visit me. There were some generals to visit me and some others in hospital. And that was all right until the parachute general Ramke was captured in Brest. And the American authority did not think it wise to have him in the camp and parachutists as well. They didn't trust us. So they moved all German parachutists out and sent us to Florida.
What would these top brass officers say to you when they visited?
Just like an old pal talking to you, asking you how you are and this and that.
What did you think about the progress of the war at this time? What did you think was going to happen?
Well, we were all waiting for the invasion, D-Day. We thought they would be thrown back into the water. So when we were all cheering when D-Day actually took place. the camp itself. Now, I must mention something else. In the prisoner of war camps, the transit camps in Africa, we were not allowed to send postcards or messages, even through the Red Cross, to let people know that we are safe. They just did not entertain the idea of letting anybody know. If it was a planned matter to demoralize the German public by having 200,000 or so relatives waiting for a message from their next of kin or so, I don't know. Maybe they tried to demoralize the population. It may be sinister to suggest it, but anyhow, it may have been a failure just of the organizers. I mean, I don't know. So when we arrived in America, we were allowed to write immediately. So many postcards a week, and so many letters a week. I can't remember the exact figures. Anyhow, I was writing my letter and postcard, which arrived in November 43 at my home. All this time, my relatives, my father, my mother, they were left in a limbo. They didn't know if I had survived or not. My last message to them was that I was wounded. Apart from this, they knew nothing, because I was captured shortly afterwards. So we were allowed to write, and the first reply I had from my relatives was in, I believe, March 1944. That was the first message I had from my relatives. So it shows you only the delay and the distance and so on. I mean, it has to go to Switzerland, I suppose, and then from there it has to go somewhere else, to a neutral country, and then to America, or vice versa. But I know of one example where it went quicker. An Englishman, he was taken prisoner, and it went to a camp in Germany. But in fact, the Englishman was prisoner in Japan. So in Germany, they realized what was going on, and the letter went by airmail to Japan and was delivered in a very, very short time. And it's just a matter of if you're lucky or not. A friend of mine whom you have interviewed, Gavin Cadden, after he was taken prisoner, he was taken by plane to Italy. And on the plane, there were some of his fellow prisoners, plus a few German staff officers. And one of them interviewed the different people and said, "Give me your name and address, and I will ask Lord Hoho to broadcast your name and say that you're in captivity and you're well." And one of his sisters, of one of the men, had picked the broadcast up, noted the names because they were repeated, and passed it on to, first of all, her own relatives, and then on to the parachute regiment, who informed the different prisoners' relatives about it. So he must have been somebody in a high position to be able to not only to get it there, but assure the prisoners that it will be broadcast. So it's a luck of a draw, if you're lucky or if you're unlucky. Anyhow, we were in the camp in Clinton, Mississippi, which was a large building site outside the camp. The river Mississippi had been flooding regular for as long as time exists, and they tried to build a Mississippi River project, a scale model of a Mississippi River, trying to prevent floodings and major catastrophes and so on. So it was a huge building project there. The whole area was cordoned off. It was a square miles of project, but the guards were standing on the outside there, and the prisoners with civilians were working in the inside.
So the POWs were working on the Mississippi River project?
Yes. And this project went on until after the war. I was moved by then because I went to Florida. But after the war, the prisoners of war of Clinton, Mississippi, established contact with the population, and there has been exchange of different dignitaries and ex-prisoners. Some go there and some go here and so on. Coming September, I think it is, the mayor of Clinton will be a guest in Germany, the ex-prisoners reunion there. So the thing took root after the war, and quite a number of our prisoners went on one occasion to Clinton and were made honorary citizens of Clinton. So as I said, I was moved to Camp Blanding in Florida. Camp Blanding was a large military base. There were troops on training to be put in action against the Japanese, so we told. They had firing ranges there. You woke up with a bang of artillery, or you had some fighter planes coming low over your camp, and you had them shooting at targets and so on. It was, as I said, a large military training camp. There were 50 warehouses which were partly manned by prisoners of war. There was a large laundry partly manned by prisoners of war, and a large tailor shop. So, as I said, we were moved there, all the parachutists. And by then, already quite a number of parachutists had been in the camp and had good positions there in administration and all the necessary things. So one of them said to me, "Well, you don't want to work. You don't want to work too hard. How about working in the tailor shop? It is a night shift, but you work on piecework, and once the quota has been achieved, they take you back to the camp. So if you work fast, you go to work at 6 in the evening, and by 9 o'clock you're back in the camp again. That's your day's work, and you have all morning for yourself here." So I went there, but bad luck, after a couple of weeks or so in the camp, that place caught fire and burned down. So my friends found me another job, quite a cushy job and so on. This was all right until the 7th of May, and that is a day of shame for all Americans, not a day of shame for us when they show us the films of concentration camps, the shame of a day of shame for all the evil they were doing on us. The camp commandant removed us. I was working in the laundry at the time on a hot mango. So we were working on this hot mango and ironed sheets, in other words. At the end of that machine, there was a black woman called Georgia. She moved all the sheets away and brought new ones in. The supervisor of that camp was a man with a German name, Krüger. He was an American who lived for centuries in Florida. His family, I mean. So when we had to leave his workplace, the commandant told us the war had finished. We are no more prisoners of war. We are now disarmed enemies. We will be treated the same like a prisoner of war, but we are not prisoners of war anymore. We will be relieved of our oath and all these sort of things. For our own safety, he said, we were kept in camp on that day. I don't know what he meant by for our own safety, because we got on very well with the civil population, as well as with his guards. In this laundry, we had permanent guards who came with us, so they were like part of us. So we had nothing to fear from them. We had nothing to fear from the black population. But what happened was, we found out the next day, they had built a cage around the hot mangle we were working, a cage with very, very strong wire, even wire on top, with just one entry on this side and another, an entry and an exit. An entry where the woman could deliver the sheets, and the exit where she could remove a finished product. The guards had to stand outside, and we were kept like animals. In the meantime, they had removed all food from the camp and replaced it by something which was hardly describable as food. For instance, there was a sausage, a small sausage, which had in big blue letters, or blue bottle kind of color, the word imitation on it. We were from then on systematically starved. We were, to the embarrassment of the guards and civil population, the black people, realizing what was going on, supported us by giving that black woman called Georgia little food parcels, sandwiches and so on, hidden in the sheets, which we could eat. And the two guards, which were permanent guards, didn't see what we were doing, so they pretended not to see. They were embarrassed by the whole situation themselves. One of the guards was the holder of the Silver Star. In other words, he had a high-ranking bravery award. And it was embarrassing for him as well. So when we came back, we were searched. And anybody who had any food on him, it was thrown on the floor. And the guards had to trample on it, tread on it, and kick it to the side. And these were different guards to the ones we used to have in wartime. They were specially trained, I should say. And so in the camp, we were called all night, all times of the night, for roll call, so we had to get out and assemble. We were kept waiting in the middle of the night for somebody to do the count. He couldn't count. He claimed to miscount, so we had to do the whole thing again. There were other things. We had our hair shorn off. There was hardly anything left. If you know the field, if you visualize Field Marshal Hindenburg and his hair, that's how we looked like, the whole lot of us. the canteen, which had previously food and beer, a Coca-Cola and ice cream, apart from other good things, had nothing except soap and soap and soap. So we could buy soap as much as we wanted, but nothing else. So we couldn't spend our money, which we had earned, on anything except soap. I had quite a good collection of soap, which came handy when I came over to England, because the British didn't have any soap. So we were not allowed to write to Germany. We were not allowed to receive letters. In fact, it remained like this until the end of October. I'd like to point out that my home was ravaged by the Russians when they came in, and we had no idea what happened to any of our next of kin. We were just concerned, we were worried, but we couldn't do anything about it. And we couldn't send anything, we couldn't receive anything. This kept on and on and on. In October, a postcard was issued, which was very humiliating. And in fact, I had enough courage to say to myself, I'm not going to sign that thing. And as a member of a defeated German army, begged the victorious Americans to be allowed to write to my next of kin. It was just not on. I know where my relatives should have been. I know that they know that I was in America. And so I say to myself, well, I have a doubt if even this postcard will get through, because it was just a matter of humiliating us. We were later on in March 1946 allowed to write one postcard. In fact, this one postcard arrived at my home, but there was not enough time for receive a reply then. So in later on in 1945, the first few months after the war, we were, according to international law, prisoners of war, were not to be politically molested, indoctrinated, or anything like this. But they said, well, you're not prisoners of war anymore, you're a discharged enemy. Something which they newly invented, I suppose. And we were forced to go, we were marched to a cinema, where first of all we were shown the newsreel of concentration camps. And we had, I was sitting in the back row, and there was one particular guard. He got the pleasure out of it, of putting the nozzle of his gun in my back. Didn't say anything, just every now and again I felt the nozzle in my back. And we had to watch this. I'm pleased that I had watched it, because I later on found out quite a number of things which later on in my activities for reconciliation, and also not only between former enemies, but also I'm well known for reconciliation between Germans and Jews, and so on. It came in very handy, this film. I remember that, every detail. So, we were told to, we were given questionnaires, what we think about Hitler and what we think about National Socialism, and this and that and something else. The way we felt at the time, the way we were treated at the time, we gave them stupid answers, which they obviously didn't want. And so it kept on. Now, this particular camp had huts of five, only five in each hut. It was in the woods, and we had plenty of flowers in there, and in the summer we had the hummingbirds coming there. So it was an idyllic situation, except that we had this shadow of ill-treatment over us. I lost an enormous lot of weight. In fact, I had, on my return, on my arrival in England, I had a photo taken about, I think, about a month after I arrived in England, which shows me in that condition, because you can't pick up very much in a month, especially not on ordinary prisoner of war food, which was better, much better than what we had in America. So this went on. It was sheer hell. They wanted to break our spirit, but they didn't. In fact, they made us more defiant rather than dejected. So I carried on my job at the laundry, and we had this excellent liaison, let us say, between us and especially the black population. I can't overemphasize it too much, because in the south of America, in the southern states of America, there is, as one American officer told us while we were still in Clinton, he said, we should respect the American way of life. There is a white man, there is a dog, and there is a black bastard, in that order. That's what he said. So, and it was like this, really, because the black man was subhuman there. And I can't overemphasize too much how well we were treated and supported by the black population. I have made many efforts to trace, for instance, this black woman called Georgia through the different administrations in Florida. I have always drawn a blank. You just didn't want to know. Once they found out it was a black person, then it was cut off. They didn't know it was a black person in the first place, but afterwards it was it. So then in April 46, we were taken out of, it was still March, it was March 46, I'm wrong. In March 46, we were taken out of a laundry, the laundry closed, the military was built up, there was reduced, the troops were not in such a large number there for training for the Japanese warfare